We're going to talk about internal evidence of the Bible, and a lot of this comes from an interview I did this Monday. This last weekend, we had Dr. Timothy McGrew here. He was speaking at UTD. He spoke at a number of churches, and he was on my radio program on Monday. He is becoming very well known. He is the chairman of the Department of Philosophy at Western Michigan University, but he also has become quite an expert on all sorts of things, like alleged contradictions in the Bible and miracles. Matter of fact, I have a commentary coming out this week on some things he's done. But he also, in the course of my interview, talked a little bit about how we can use the Bible, first of all, to explain some questions that we have about various Bible passages, and how the internal evidence for the Bible also argues for its authenticity. So if you kind of stay with me, I'm going to encourage you to look at your outline. You're also going to notice there's a box on that right-hand corner, and I'm going to have you do a few things with that, with a pen as we go along. But what we're going to try to do is really try to see, do we have evidence from the Scriptures itself that indeed it's authentic? And I use this verse as probably a good way to start off our conversation this morning, and that is, Peter says, "For we did not follow cleverly devised myths," or some of your translations will say, "cleverly devised tales, but when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but we were eyewitnesses of his majesty." And we live in a world today where you have lots of skeptics. And on this particular class, we've talked about, what about alleged contradictions in the Bible? And I've sort of answered some of those questions. And we've talked about how external evidence has really reinforced the Bible. But today we're going to use the Bible to maybe prove itself to be authentic. And so we're going to focus most of our time and attention on the Gospels. You might want to turn to Matthew or Mark or something like that. I'll try to put all the verses up here, but you may want to look at those for yourself. And, you know, when you look at the four Gospels, you recognize that they were written by eyewitnesses or else individuals who were recording eyewitness accounts. And we have a lot of external evidence, as I mentioned just a minute ago, Josephus, a Jewish historian, Tacitus, a Roman historian. We have archaeology. Matter of fact, this is a great time to be a Bible scholar because in just the last two decades, we have found major archaeological finds that have verified that some of the things that people used to attack on Luke. And Luke's important because Luke writes what? The Gospel of Luke. What else does he write? The book of Acts. And we now recognize that people said, you know, this is not accurate. You know, we don't have any evidence in history that what Luke says in the New Testament is true. And now we're finding all sorts of archaeological evidence to prove that it is. And so we found that they are accurate and well informed. But the question I want to ask this morning is, do we have any evidence within the Gospels that show us that? And I think we should recognize that if you've ever taken the time to read, maybe when you were first a Christian, somebody said, here's the New Testament. You need to read that. And so you'd read through Matthew and you go, oh, really interesting. And then you'd read in Mark and you go, there's a lot of similarity. I think I see some of that in Matthew. But you say, well, there's also some differences and some additional material. Then you get into Luke and you go, okay, this is like the third time we've gone through some of this material. But then you get to John, it was a little bit different. So the three synoptic gospels talk about some of these issues. And a lot of it was similar. But some of the differences might be very interesting. And what what Dr. Timothy McGrew has argued is that by comparing these, you can show that they were authentic. If you right now go to a public broadcasting or the History Channel, they've been lately doing some of these series where they really challenge the authenticity of the Bible. And here, this is a place where the Bible itself proves that it is authentic. Because if these were exactly identical, then you'd think that maybe it's a hoax. You've all probably watched a CSI program or some of those other kinds of things where everybody tells the same story, you know, in a fraternity or something like that, or every criminal says the same story. When it's exactly the same, that looks like a forgery, doesn't it? It looks like a fake. And the fact is that either they are all copying from the same a playlist, or one's copying from the other. And so that's some of what has been said by people that have been attacking the Bible, that in really many cases we actually have evidence that, and there's a real debate right now in seminaries, did Mark write first, and then did Matthew and Luke be able to look at that? We know John wrote last, but I think what we're going to do is use a very long word, undesigned coincidences. This, interestingly enough, was used by people in the 19th century to prove the authority of the Bible. But those books have kind of been lost. I'm going to show you a couple of those that many people now in the 21st century are coming back to. Because sometimes we see that two different works, two different gospels interlock in a way that would be unlikely if they copied each other, or if they copied from a common source. And so it shows the authenticity of all of that. And one book may mention something basically just in passing that answers a question that was raised in another book. And so the two fit together like a jigsaw puzzle. So the illustration I created was this. If indeed we look through, and you can see on your handout here, we're going to look at 10 of them. If we can see that those interlock, eventually we're going to see that this is also a very profound proof to the Bible. And it's something that you don't have to have a seminary degree to do or anything. And it also will help you answer some of the questions that maybe you've had before about indeed some of the things that Jesus says or some of the things that are said by Peter or others that don't seem to make a lot of sense. And in case you're interested, These come from these two books. And these books are part of a website that Dr. McGrew told me about. And I give him full credit for this because a lot of this is material he's put together. I created the slides, but you can even see him giving a lecture like this on YouTube. But these are books that are in the historicalapologetics.org website. And these are books that are older than everybody in the room. Matter of fact, these books are older than three or four of us in the room. I mean, these are all 19th century books that people used to use, but have been sort of lost. And he's sort of, in some respects, Tim McGrew says, sometimes when I speak, people say, he's so old, he's become new. And so I want to share with you some things that believers in the 19th century used to prove the authenticity of the New Testament, and also at the same time, maybe answer some of the questions. As I said before, fictions or various kinds of fables and things like that, forgeries, they usually don't have any loose ends. And even so, if two individuals are writing about an event, they're going to not necessarily say the same things. If there was, as I've said before, a car accident out here, somebody maybe say, well, it was a red car that hit a blue car. Somebody else is saying a Ford hit a Chevy. Somebody else is saying one was traveling east and the other was traveling west. People are going to put different things in there, but if you pull all of those together, you can begin to get the full story. And the interlocking nature of all of that, I think, is going to be very helpful. So we're going to go through these 10 pretty quickly. Is everybody with me? You might want to get a pen because in a minute I'm going to show you what you're going to do with that. But let's take the first one. The first one is very simple. In Matthew 8, we have here Peter's mother-in-law has been healed. And it says that when Jesus entered Peter's house, he saw his mother-in-law lying sick with a fever. He touched her hand, the fever left her, and she rose and began to serve him. Isn't that amazing? I've just healed her from being sick, and now she's serving. You know, she must have had a Mary Martha kind of philosophy here, right? Okay, well, nevertheless, it then goes, that evening they brought to him many who were oppressed by demons, and he cast out the spirits with a word and healed all who were sick. Now, you look at that and you go, that evening, and it raises a very good question. If people believe that Jesus could truly heal the sick, why did they wait till evening to bring people there? And this is in the town of Capernaum. Matter of fact, do I have a picture of that? Yeah, I've got a picture of that. And this is a very small town. If you've ever been on a tour with Gary Frazier or Jack Graham, or I'm going to have another one going up, we take you through there. And, you know, there's the synagogue. Actually, this is a synagogue which was built on the synagogue that Jesus preached in. And there off to the right is what many people believe was the home of Peter, because many of the early Christians believed it was. And they had good reason to actually hold to that belief. And so it's a pretty small community. So he heals the mother-in-law, but they wait till evening for anybody else to bring the sick. Well, the answer to that, interesting enough, comes from the Gospel of Mark. And it's actually just sort of said in passing, because it talks about the fact that Jesus went into Capernaum. Immediately on the Sabbath, he entered the synagogue and was teaching, and immediately left the synagogue. Now, this is still during the Sabbath, and entered the house of Simon and Andrew with James and John. He came and took her by the hand, lifted her up, and the fever left her, and she began to serve. Now, that's all during what? The Sabbath. Then, look at the next line. That evening at sundown, after the Sabbath was over, what happened? Everyone brought to him all who were sick and oppressed by demons. Jesus had no problem healing on the Sabbath, but all the other obedient Jews waited till the Sabbath was over, and that's why they brought them all in. Does that answer a question? Well, if you look at your little diagram here, we can begin to see how this would be helpful, because one undesigned coincidence might just be an accident. But as you're going to see, we're going to go through 10, and there are many more, but I only wanted to do 10 in the interest of time, fit together, and numerous undesigned coincidences are unlikely to all be accidental. So the point I'm going to suggest is, look at that box to the right there. We just now have proven that Mark helps explain Matthew. So if you want, with your pen, just draw a line from Mark to Matthew. You're going to see where this is going. This thing's going to fill up with arrows, but you can now see a question that we had in the book of Matthew is answered by the Gospel of Mark. Let's look at another one. Luke 9. Now this is kind of interesting, because now here we're at the Mount of Transfiguration, and here the cloud overshadows them. You've seen Jesus in his glorified state, and you have Moses and Elijah and the disciples and everything. And then of course a voice comes out of the cloud, "My son, my chosen one, listen to him." And when the voice was spoken, Jesus was found alone. And then, so then they've had Moses and Elijah, and then now there's Jesus. The next line has got to be just a tad puzzling. It says, "And they kept silent, and no one in those days said anything of what they had seen." Now, does that make any sense to you at all? Let's imagine you're with Jack Graham, and he's on the Mount of Transfiguration. All of a sudden, Moses and Elijah show up. You have the voice of God, and all of this is taking place. And then, how many seconds would it take before one of you are on your phone saying, "You will not believe what I just saw"? As you go down the mountain, maybe you'd wait just long enough and then say, "You cannot believe what happened." And nobody has said what? Anything. That's a real puzzle if you think about that, right? But put yourself in that position. Well, again, we find an answer, and we find that in this case, the Gospel of Mark. Because as it says, as they were coming down, Jesus charged them to tell no one what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. And so what was a question in the Gospel of Matthew is then very easily answered in the Gospel of Mark. So now draw another line from Mark now answering Luke. And I think you're going to begin to see where we're going to eventually have lots of lines where there's interlocking between each one of those Gospels. Okay, let's take the third one then. Everybody with me so far? Nothing else. Drawing lines keeps us awake here after all the things we did in the scavenger hunt. I've had some people say, "Can I just have a pillow? I am so tired after all the things we've been doing this weekend." Okay, number three, Mark. Here's a little bit different one. This one now has to do with the feeding of the 5,000. And this is on the other side of the Sea of Galilee. And then eventually Jesus walks on the water, goes to Capernaum, which we just talked about. But it has two puzzles if you just read the Gospel of Mark. First, it said, "He said to them, 'Come away by yourselves to a desolate place and rest a while, for many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat.'" Now, if you've ever been to that part of Israel or anywhere around the Sea of Galilee, you're going, this doesn't look like a real busy place, even in the 21st century. And it really probably wasn't much of a busy place in the first century. And yet it talks about crowds and people coming and going, and they had to pull away from all those crowds. Well, some of the crowds could have been the crowds that were following him, but it's talking about people coming and going. So it's not just the crowds following Jesus. There are people coming by them and walking up and down the trails there. So that's the first question. Second question is, he commanded them to sit down in groups on the green grass. At this point, I think you're going to be saying, green grass? If you've not been to Israel, think Northern California, the dry brown hills. This is kind of what it looks like. That doesn't look like where people would be sitting down in green grass. So we got all these people, and we have them sitting down in the grass. So what's that all about? Well, this is now where we go to the Gospel of John. And in Gospel of John, John 6:4, it says, "Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand." Ah, now the light goes on. Because point number one is, during the Passover, there were all the pilgrims walking past the Sea of Galilee, many times going to Jerusalem, maybe going to other places, but most likely going there. So there were all sorts of crowds going up and down the byways, all up and down the various trails. And so Jesus pulls them away from all of the hustle and bustle that probably only existed during the time, say, of the Passover. Number two, we know when Passover takes place, and that's during what? The growing season, and that be probably is one of the very few times where you'd see green grass right there as well. So again, if you want to draw another line, I think we could this time now say John helps explain Mark. And so we can begin to see how each one of these interlock. Now, if John were simply quoting from Mark or someone like that, although he may have had access to that, that is the case, but each one of them in passing say something else that helps explain something in the scriptures that never really made complete sense if you read just that gospel. Which, by the way, if you've ever had somebody that's a new Christian, they say, "Why do you have four gospels?" They say, "Well, why do you have two speakers in your stereo? Or why do you have quadraphonics?" You know, it's the life of Jesus in quadraphonics, right? You know, and some of you actually have been in theaters where they have multiple speakers. Parker went to one the other day where it even had wind blowing in your face and poking you and shaking the, you know, everything during Star Wars. I don't know. I think I might need some kind of bonnet or something. But nevertheless, you know, we get all of the experience here. And once again, we'll see one more. So let's look at number four, because I want to move our way through that. And in this particular case, this is really a puzzle, because here we see that Herod kills who? John the Baptist. But then he hears about Jesus baptizing individuals in most likely the Jordan River. And he believes that this is like maybe a resurrection or reincarnation of John the Baptist. And so we read this in Matthew 14. "At the time, Herod the Tetrarch heard about the fame of Jesus, and he said to his servants, 'This is John the Baptist. He has been raised from the dead. That is why these miraculous powers are at work in him.'" Now, there's a question about this. How in the world does Matthew know this? I mean, you could come up with kind of a spiritual answer. Well, the Holy Spirit gave him that answer. But how does Matthew, a tax collector, traveling with Jesus, nowhere near the temple, nowhere near Herod, know anything of what Herod is saying to his servants? That's a pretty good question, isn't it? Well, let's go to Luke, and it now helps us, again, with just a statement in passing that helps answer the question. It tells us the individuals, the women, by the way, the women get high marks in the New Testament, the women that actually supported Jesus. Sometimes people say, well, how did Jesus, you know, survive? And part of it was from the largesse, part of the giving, part of the generosity of some of the women. And it talks about two of those, one, Joanna, and the other, Susanna. But here's this little phrase. It says, "Joanna, the wife of Chuza," who's Chuza? Chuza is the household manager of Herod. Ah, now that starts answering the question. Here, Joanna, who traveled with Jesus, her husband is the household manager of Herod. Don't you know those conversations must have been interesting? But nevertheless, no doubt she heard from her husband that what? Herod believed that John the Baptist had been risen from the dead, shares that with Joanna. That gets shared with Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, whoever happens to be there, either recording it after the fact, or perhaps even with Peter and James and John and Matthew during the time. But nevertheless, we see now how Matthew knows indeed what actually was said inside that particular event. And so again, we can draw another line now from Luke to Matthew, because now Luke helps answer one of the questions we have in Matthew. Everybody still with me? I'll keep it moving here. Let's go to number five real quickly. And that is, now we have another real puzzle in the Gospels. And that is, at one point, this is where Jesus actually issues his woes. And he says, "Woe to Chorazin, and woe to you, Bethsaida. For if the mighty works done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes." Now, here's a question about that. Well, okay, if I'm reading through, especially the Gospel of Matthew, I don't really see any of those works. What are the good works? Now, the scriptures are not actually supposed to tell us everything, because we don't really have anything about what Jesus did to Chorazin other than we see that apparently there were good works done there. But Bethsaida, that shows up a lot. We've already seen that show up a couple of times, haven't we? And again, this is a place where now the Gospel of Luke helps answer the question. Because it says, on their return, the apostles told him all that they had done, and he took them and withdrew apart to the town called Bethsaida. And here, when the crowds learned it, they followed him and welcomed them and spoke to them of the kingdom of God, and notice that, and cured those who had need of healing. So here, and here, if you've never been to Holy Land, here is Bethsaida. This is a judgment that he called upon them. But here, apparently, there were great healing ministries and great miracles being performed. But yet, apparently, from what Jesus is saying here, there was unbelief. They said, thank you for healing me. Be warmed and healed and filled, and they went on their way. And so this, again, helps answer a question, because Jesus obviously then brings a judgment down for their unbelief. And this, again, helps us answer another question. In this case, one more of those arrows where Luke also helps explain Matthew. We're half done. Let's work. Continue moving down the road here. And let's go to number 6 here. And in this particular case, we are back to the feeding of the 5,000. And here in John 6, verse 5, we studied this last semester. It says, lifting up his eyes and seeing the multitude and seeing that a large crowd was coming towards Jesus, then he said to Philip, where are we to buy bread so that all these people may eat? Now, that's kind of an interesting question if you think about that. Just think about who Jesus might ask to buy bread. Well, the first one that comes to my mind is, who carried the money pouch? Judas. Okay, maybe that would be one. Who was kind of the leader of the band at that point? It's pretty much Peter. Oh, he doesn't ask Peter, doesn't ask Judas. Okay, John, you know, because, you know, he's the beloved disciple. Doesn't ask him. Somebody maybe well connected, like a tax collector, Matthew. You're working your way down the list. You know, the upper tier doesn't get the question. I hate to say it, but Philip is kind of in the lower tier sometimes, isn't he? Because, you know, he only gets mentioned once or twice, but that's going to help us answer the question. But again, why Philip, interestingly enough? Well, let's look at that. First, we have to go to Luke to help us understand where they were. And we, of course, know that, but I just wanted to establish that. That on their return, the disciples told him what they'd done. He took them and withdrew to a town called Bethsaida, where the crowds learned and followed him and welcomed them and spoke to them of the kingdom of God and cured those who had need of healing. So again, we're talking about Bethsaida, and that helps us a little bit. So we know, okay, the feeding of the 5,000 is just down from Bethsaida, right there by the Sea of Galilee, kind of on the other side, more on the eastern side. But then you have to go one more, and that is to go to John 12. When Jesus enters into Jerusalem, you know, on Palm Sunday, there are some Greeks there that want to meet Jesus, so they pull Philip aside and say, we wish to see Jesus. But in the description, John says, who was Philip, who was from what? Bethsaida in Galilee. Now we understand why Jesus asked that. And that is, he's the local boy. What he's basically saying is, okay, we got about 5,000, I don't think it was just 5,000 men. There may have been as many as 10 to 15,000 people there. And the only reason they were all there, now we know, is because of the Passover. They're coming and going. And he's saying, okay, can we feed all these people? And he asks the local boy, how's the bakery there? Do we have enough bread in Bethsaida to feed all these people? And of course, what does Philip say? No way. We don't have enough McDonald's. We don't have enough Burger Kings. We don't have enough bakeries. We don't have anything like this. And he uses that to establish the case. And so we can see, interestingly enough, why does Jesus ask Philip? Because he is from right down the road, and he would know whether or not it would be possible, even if we were to get bread from every house in Bethsaida, whether it would be enough to feed these 5,000 people? And the answer is no. So if you're drawing some lines, having fun drawing lines and nothing else, now notice how Luke actually answers part of that question in John. And you have to go from Luke to John back again to finally get the answer. Does that help a little bit? So anyway, let's take a couple more. Number 7. Now we're at the Gospel of Mark, and here we see that when Jesus is accused, they say, that is the Jews that are accusing him, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another not made with hands. That's the accusation. Then later when he's on the cross, it says those who pass by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, aha, you would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days. Well, there's a real problem. You can read through the Gospel of Mark and you see no evidence that Jesus ever said anything like this. You, matter of fact, don't see anything that could be twisted. You know, notice how people during this political season are twisting people's words. Well, even taking something that he might have said about the temple, there's just nothing in the Gospel of Mark that gives you any answer to why they would even use that as an accusation. Until you again go to another gospel. And if you go to John chapter 2, it says, so the Jews said to him, and now this is after he has overturned what? The tables. Okay? This is during the first Passover. And Jesus answered, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will rise it up. I will raise it up. So here we have the answer in John. And here it's kind of interesting because John gives the original statement, and the synoptic gospels give the accusation, but it's pretty much impossible that either copied from the either of the others, because they're very different. And, you know, you have these debates right now in seminary. You know, did Mark write first? And I'm probably sure that he did. And then maybe Matthew and then Luke and John was last. But here you begin to see it doesn't really make a whole lot of difference, does it? Interestingly enough. Okay, one more arrow. Now John explains what? Mark. And you're beginning to see the interconnected in of all of this. A couple more and then we'll call it a day. But number 8, now we are talking about after the resurrection. Where is Peter and everybody? They're back in the Sea of Galilee up in the north. They're fishing. And then, you know, Jesus calls them. They recognize him. You know, they have more fish than they can bring in. And they then have a breakfast of fish and everything that he started. And then Jesus, in the midst of this, said, when they finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? And of course, Simon says, yes, you know that I love you. But this is one of those times where you get the sense of Jesus is a little bit harsh. Maybe even a little bit of a smart aleck. Why did you just, you love me, but you love me more than these other disciples? You know, and that's one of the so-called hard sayings of Jesus. And if you really begin to put the Gospels together, you realize that sometimes where it looks like he's being just a little bit mean, vindictive, he's trying to drive the point home, turn the screw, whatever you want to say, you realize that even the way he says it had a significance. And the way you find that answer is go to the Gospel of Matthew. And that is, did I hit the wrong one? I hit the wrong one. There we go. Got it there. And that is, you know, where Jesus talking about, you know, you will deny me. And what is, we find out Peter saying? He says, though they will fall away because of you, I will never fall away. Basically what Peter is saying to Jesus is, they'll all deny you, but I love you. And I do love you more than all these other disciples. So Jesus is bringing him back to that real question. Do you really love me more than these? And of course, he asks it 3 times because of the 3 denials. But again, if you're looking for how to fill that out, let's just say that in this case, we see that Matthew explains John. Are you starting to see the interconnectedness of the scriptures? Again, these are undesigned coincidences, some of these apologists in the 19th century said. And if nothing else, you can just use the Bible to prove the Bible. Because the Bible shows itself to be authentic. It shows itself to be not something that's a forgery or something where individuals were copying from one another. And indeed, you have a real opportunity to see the truthfulness and the inspiration of the scriptures. Okay, 2 more real quickly. Number 9. Now, here is one where they are appearing before Pilate and making the accusation before Jesus. And I'll just read it here, because, "And they began to accuse him, saying, 'We found this man misleading our nation and forbidding us to give tribute to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ a king.'" Okay, the first one's bad enough, misleading the nation, but, you know, again, Pilate might go, "Well, that's your Jewish problem, I don't care." Forbidding them to give tribute, okay, that's pretty severe. You know, it's like some of the people that every once in a while call into my talk show and say, "You know, I looked this up and we actually are not required to pay our income tax." And I said, "Well, call me 5 years from now from prison and let me tell you how that's going." But, you know, okay, that's one of those. But that one's a little bit of a problem. But here, the third one, that's a deal breaker, because he said he was a king. There's only one king in the Roman Empire. That's Caesar. And so then, you know, Pilate says, "Are you a king of the Jews?" And he answers, "You have said so." And then Pilate said to the chief priests and crowds, "I found no guilt in him." Huh? Let's think this through a little bit. The Jews make some very significant accusations. The big one is, of course, that he claimed to be a king. Pilate questions Jesus about those accusations, and apparently Jesus said, "Well, you've said so," which is sort of admitting to it. And so then Pilate declares Jesus as innocent. Does that make any sense? Well, it doesn't unless you pull together the Gospel of John. And the Gospel of John, and this you might want to read its in entirety, so I put a fair number of ellipses there just to get us through the screen here. But so Pilate entered the headquarters again and called the Jews and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Asking that. And Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world." John, I think, wanted to put that in there to maybe clarify what somebody might not have understood, or maybe just felt that that was part of it. And because he probably was there watching some of that, actually had access to it the way others did not. And after this, he went back outside to the Jews and told them, "I find no guilt in him." And so we can begin to see here that indeed that adds a very important point. But it adds it in a way that's very interesting, because John's gospel describes the scene and gives the question, and it also provides Pilate's response. But think about this. Luke gives the accusation and not the answer. Interesting enough, John gives the answer, but he doesn't give the accusation. So in a sense, each of the gospels explain the other. You can't really completely understand, interestingly enough, Luke without John, and you can't understand John without Luke. So I suggested you put arrows going both ways. Have I confused your whole diagram enough to illustrate the point? And that is these undesigned coincidences. One more real quickly, and that is just simply to pick up on this issue of before Pilate. And in John 18, you know, it tells us, of course, that Peter, you know, wields a sword. Wasn't very good, but he cuts off the right ear of Malchus, the high priest. And then later, when Jesus is in John talking with Pilate, he says, "My kingdom is not of this world." Here's the rest of it. "If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I might not be delivered over to the Jews, but my kingdom is not from this world." Okay, well, you say, I don't know, taking a guy's ear off, that strikes me as fighting, doesn't it? And so some people have suggested, some of the apologists have said, well, if you go back to Luke 22, you know, what does Jesus say at one point? He says, "No more of this." And then he touches the ear of the high priest's servant, Malchus, and he's healed. Matter of fact, there's a lot of church tradition that suggests that he actually became an elder in the church. Can you imagine an individual, because his name shows up in some of these documents, and can you imagine, you know, you give your testimony. You know, all of us have a great testimony, but, you know, Peter takes off my ear, and then Jesus touches it, and look at this. I still got two ears. So, you know, it would have been a great testimony all through Jerusalem, wouldn't it? Obviously, that means he turned away from the high priest. But nevertheless, now Peter could not be arrested because there's no physical evidence of any struggle, and no one could actually convict Jesus or contradict him of any kind of claim. Well, the point I'm making is you've seen that diagram. What does your diagram look like right now? You got arrows going every which way? I wanted to end on time, but if you go through that book, and I just mentioned some of these books here, you can begin to realize that the scriptures really reaffirm the truthfulness of that. And so it looks like this is not a forgery. These are not individuals copying from one another. These are not people faking the stories. These were people that were authentic eyewitnesses. And remember my opening verse there? 2 Peter. We were eyewitnesses. We did not follow cleverly divine myths or tales, but we were eyewitnesses. And this shows all the evidence of eyewitnesses. Now, again, all the way through, I've talked about the fact that this proves inspiration. Well, there's much more that proves inspiration. But even if you just simply looked at this like a CSI investigator and said, okay, does this testimony corroborate with this testimony? Yes, and there's some differences, which is exactly what I would expect. But there are also some pieces where they interlock. And this looks to me like an authentic document. And so, if nothing else, this is an argument that's really been lost for almost a century now, but I wanted to kind of revive it and just show you once again that the Scriptures can be used to prove the truthfulness of the Scriptures. Just before I turn it back over to Parker, one of the things I also wanted to do is mention that this a week ago, I had a chance to interview Rafael Cruz. And if you're not familiar, he has a new book out called A Time for Action, Empowering the Faithful to Reclaim America. And it was just a great interview, and I brought, as I oftentimes do, CDs of that, so we got those up front here. And it's kind of fun because, first of all, he talks about growing up in Cuba and actually having so many difficulties, and they actually, with a rifle butt, knocked most of his teeth out just recently. As a matter of fact, even here, he had just gotten out of the hospital because he had a detached retina, and I think some of that could have been from, you know, all the things he went through over the years. But anyway, I got out of Cuba and really came to this country with some money sewn into his underwear, and then began to work his way through and eventually graduated from the University of Texas, and then was in the oil business, and then began to lead a life that wasn't always as good as it could be. And so when he was in Canada, began to separate from his wife and from Ted Cruz. I don't know what's happened to him, but he's around somewhere, you know, and then came back, and then some friends of his said, I want you to read this booklet, and I want you to come back next week, and I will talk about it. And it was the Four Spiritual Laws. And so he read it through, and he came back that next week and said, it just can't be that easy. She said, it really is. And he became a Christian. And so on the interview, he also talks about becoming a Christian. And then the rest of the book is about how he's been traveling the country, really trying to mobilize and encourage pastors, all Christians, but especially pastors, to address these issues. And Gary Frazier next week will probably speak to this issue, because Gary Frazier is the executive director of Churches Impacting Culture. And they've done a couple of things. First of all, they've done some surveys of pastors, over 400 different conservative pastors, and have found that most pastors will agree that the Bible addresses many issues, but then they also will admit that they don't preach on those issues. You know, not everything is Prestonwood Baptist Church. For example, almost all the pastors they interviewed agreed that the Bible speaks to issues like abortion and marriage and things like that. But then when they asked them, less than 50% of them had preached a message on abortion or same-sex marriage or anything like that. Then when they ask on other issues, most of them, at least 75% to 80% sometimes agreed that the Bible addressed those issues. And sometimes the number that actually had preached on that in a year was like in the single digits. And Gary Frazier has done some work in that regard. And so that's the first issue, that pastors really need to address those issues. The second, which I know Gary Frazier will talk about, is the survey that showed in the last presidential election, using George Barna's numbers, identifying people that have had a born-again experience in the past that is still meaningful to them today, they concluded that 39 million born-again Christians did not vote in the last election. It's two-thirds, one-third. 26 million were registered to vote but did not vote. 13 million were not even registered to vote. You'll notice over the next couple of weeks, due to the leadership of Ron Kelly, we're going to be handing out these voter registration cards. Because guess what? We found out there are people even in this church that are not registered to vote. And so that's the first issue. But then second of all, really encouraging people to vote their values and to find out more about the candidate. So anyway, I'm stealing a little Gary Frazier's presentation next week. I'm sure he'll be talking about prophecy and everything else. But anyway, Rafael Cruz has been involved in that as well. And there's just been a real desire to mobilize pastors. There's a gathering that I'm probably going to be doing a radio broadcast on April 9th before the Lincoln Memorial. They wanted to have me and Mark Davis do it. Mark Davis can't do it right now because his mother's dying of cancer, but we're going to be doing a broadcast from Washington, D.C. It'll be on Saturday. I'll be back in time for church. Don't worry about that. But nevertheless, we're going to be doing that, and they hope to have 30,000 pastors in front of the Lincoln Memorial praying. So whether it's Rafael Cruz or whether it's Gary Fraser, there are a lot of people that just feel like this is our year to make sure that Christians are praying and taking seriously all of the information that we have available and voting their values. So if nothing else, Rafael Cruz and Parker, I'll turn it back over to you.